we present 25 years of the News Quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome to the News Quiz's 25th birthday. It's a celebratory show rampaging through the past 25 years of headlines. And we start with a cutting scene in the Southampton local paper back in the year 2000, read by Peter Donaldson.
Film competition. To win, all you have to do is answer the following question. Who starred in Enter the Dragon? Answers on a postcard, please, to Bruce Lee competition.
Let's meet the teams. Please welcome first on my right, Andy Hamilton, John Sargent and Linda Smith. And opposite them on my left, Alan Corran, Francis Ween and Jeremy Hardy. And before we start round one, here's an item from The Surveyor, read by Corrie Caulfield.
Lewisham Council has decided to start charging £20 for replacement bins after a series of other measures failed to stop its bin population walking. Officers have so far failed to solve the mystery of a Lewisham wheelie bin that was found floating in the Sea of Galilee.
Thanks to Stephen Scott of Camberley for that, and I should say the newsreaders have all chosen their favourite clippings of the past, and that was the first one Corrie ever read on the show. Andy, why were royalists not singing God Save the Queen back in 1977?
This is ludicrous that I've been given this question. This is about the Silver Jubilee, isn't it, in 1977, and I hadn't even been born. I mean, but from what I remember in the history books, sometime around the start of that year, the Queen got up one morning, looked at the calendar and said, gosh, I've been Queen for 25 years. I'd better get my subjects to pay for a big celebration. Things were quite optimistic then, I think, for the royal family. And I think if you could have frozen it in time, it would have been very hard to predict that even the whole notion of having a royal family would be called into question by the grisly tragedy of Prince Edward's It's a Royal Knockout. It kind of shook the royalty to its foundations. And
it was a very different period, wasn't it? People were worried about the economy, crime was rising, we had a Labour government. And not all that many people trusted the Prime Minister. My trouble is I can remember the coronation a bit better than the Silver Jubilee. I don't know whether anyone else finds that. When I was at primary school, I had to make a cut-out copy of the gold state coach. And
that sounds highly educational.
No, it was extremely good. And I was very impressed the other day when I saw the same coach being used for this last Jubilee. The wheels were turning. Nobody told me about that.
Was your cutout of the coach put up on the wall?
No, it was too small for that. It was rather delicately made.
Because that can scar you for life when you slave over a bit of artwork and then they don't put it up on the wall, Mrs. Wilkinson, you old witch.
I think it must have been at my... I remember that. We had to do exactly the same. And I can remember very clearly that field, because sensation is much more than memory. We put them together with Airfix, and I had six horses on my forefinger for about 3 days. It just reminded me wonderfully there, that Proustian bit. Mm. Which primary school were you at?
It was called Great Two Primary School, and we were given coronation periscopes, so you could hide behind chairs and peer out as if you were looking at the crowd in the mall, but we never got that far.
We had periscopes, because it was a mixed school, and they had showers. We never used them for the coronation. You actually saw the Queen in the shower, did you?
Back then, the public were much more deferential to the royal family, and there was still a residue of sympathy left over from their country's tragic defeat in the 1966 World Cup final. I knew you'd get there. The Silver Jubilee was possibly the first truly multicultural event to take place in the UK ever, a chance for all people, regardless of race or creed, to be insulted by Prince Philip. John, why did counting them all out lead to counting them in for a second term?
Oh, right. Well, this is the Falklands War, of course, 1982. I was already quite old and following what was going on very carefully. But the best moment, we all remember it, don't we? It's when Margaret Thatcher decided to announce herself with the Defence Secretary the recapture of South Georgia. It was a dark night at number 10 Downing Street. And someone asked a question or tried to ask a question, and she turned on them and said, "Rejoice! Just rejoice!" And I knew many of the media people who were there. And the idea that they would spontaneously dance in the streets of London was just so absurd and wonderful.
Of course, you, at that time, would have been following her quite closely when she was off round the world on her Blonde Ambition tour at that time.
Right.
And you were one of her roadies, in a way.
I was, yes. She always liked a bit of a fight, usually with me.
At the end of the two-month campaign, Max Hastings was the first Briton to enter Port Stanley. Though how Stanley felt about it is anybody's guess. Linda, listen to this. Hey ho from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Linda.
Hi ho, not hey ho. It's I ho.
He's right, you know.
Linda, who didn't dig the miners?
Mrs. Thatcher. We're talking about the miners' strike, I'm taking it. And at the time of the miners' strike... Now, I mean, this will surprise younger listeners, because back in the day, unions used to represent their members rather than sell you pensions and holiday insurance. So there was this big, big miners' strike. And I, at the time, was living in Sheffield, in the heart of South Yorkshire. It was at the heart of the strike there. And there was a great story, actually, from one of the local pits, Coulton Wood. It was sort of winter and it was really freezing cold. And the miners, to sort of cheer themselves up and keep warm on the picket line, had built a lovely snowman, you know, with a little scarf and a jolly hat and everything. Lovely thing it was. And a policeman in a Land Rover, a Range Rover, came along and smashed it down. Isn't that mean? Really mean. Smashed down their lovely snowman. So they built another snowman. They weren't deterred. They built another snowman. So the policeman came along in his Range Rover and knocked it down again. Only thing is, this time they built it over a bollard.
But there is this nostalgia for coal, because people, of course, have coal-effect electric fires. But in 50 years' time, we will have exhausted all other sources of energy. We will need that coal, and then people will have to have electricity-effect coal fires. With the coal rolled into two bars and an ornamental switch on the side.
Can I just say I'm a unique figure in the history of this country, Mrs. Thatcher, because while she was Prime Minister, I was invited by a Labour MP who had a sitcom that he'd written. And he invited me to the House of Commons. I don't know what happened to the sitcom. I think it got turned into a composite motion or something. But I got invited there, and he led me through these maze of corridors. And coming the other way was a civil servant with a huge pile of folders and files. Next to him, gripping her handbag in that very stiff-armed way that no human being has ever done since, walking towards me was Mrs. Thatcher. And we did that thing that you do with tourists in Oxford Street sometimes, where there's no room to pass, so we both stepped to the same side and then sort of looked embarrassed and shrugged. And then we did the same thing, we both stepped the other way, and then finally we squeezed past each other. And as we squeezed past, she distinctly said to me, "Sorry, that makes me the only person in Britain..." person in Britain that Thatcher said sorry to.
During the miners' strike, thousands of police were drafted in from all over the country. There was a terrifying moment when dozens of miners were chased onto a railway line. Well, in those days, there was always the faint chance a train might go by. Before we go on to Alan Steam, here's a notice about refuse collection for the bank holiday period in 1988, and it's read by Brian Perkins.
Parts of the Thursday collections will be made on Christmas Eve, but collections normally made late on a Thursday will be made on the Tuesday after Christmas, together with collections normally made on a Friday. Monday and Tuesday collections will be made on the Wednesday and Thursday after Christmas, with some Tuesday collections left until the Monday after New Year. During the week after New Year, therefore, some Tuesday collections will be made on Monday, Wednesday, or Thursday, and Friday collections on Thursday or Friday. Merry Christmas.
Thanks to several residents of Buckinghamshire and for Brian for remembering it. Jeremy, whose Black September was a long, long way from sunny May?
Black Wednesday, this would be. Is it?
It would.
Black Wednesday, 10 years ago. The fact that we use black to denote evil or despair has implications the way we talk about race, because we talk about a black mood or a black mark or a black look, and indeed we talk about the Black Death. And of course, Black Death is what this refers to. It was, of course, the plague 10 years ago, when rats in the city of London, plague-ridden rats, ran into the money markets for protection from a fire which had been started by King Alfred, who was hiding in the oak tree, teaching the spider to burn puddings. And consequently created this panic, and the pound collapsed, and we had to leave the exchange rate mechanism. And Norman Lamont, the most owl resembling of Pinochet's supporters, in his rather bitter memoirs, says that he was desperately trying to get out of the RM, but that John Major was inaccessible because he was playing bowls with St. Francis of Assisi.
There were a lot of stories, weren't there, that John Major had gone mad that day, then he refused to see Norman
He'd gone
Lamont.
Mad and gone,
And you're bound to get those stories, because to lose, what, more than £14 billion in one day takes quite a lot of explaining, doesn't it?
There's nothing to explain. We were run by a blithering idiot. The Frank Spencer of British politics.
The best joke I heard about Major was written by Nick Revel, and he said that Major had had a very difficult childhood because as a child he'd been someone else's imaginary friend.
The key to John Major's character was that he ran away from the circus to be an accountant.
Lamont was later to be involved in a scandal over the fact that he leased his basement flat to a Miss Whiplash, a specialist in tight restraints and firm discipline, who now goes under the name of Gordon Brown. Francis, did things get any better?
Ah, this must be the brave new dawn of 1997. But I do remember it very well, because we had to do a news quiz the following day at about lunchtime, and the whole audience and the panel had been up all night, and there was a certain amount of euphoria, but I think it was partly to do with being up all night and having drunk a lot. It was all sort of, you know, new Labour and new Britain, and big tent reaching out to everyone, you know, something for everyone in there. It was, we're firm but fair and nasty but nice and on message but off our rocker, and... And it was all so groovy that everyone loved it for about 5 minutes until we discovered that they were just the same old bunch of crooks. But anyway, it was nice while it lasted. Which
5 minutes, you sweet old-fashioned thing.
We were in such a good mood. We went to the pub. We were
we
all
did
so
go
happy.
To the pub.
It was a lovely
Simon.
Day for
it
us
was
all.
A beautiful
wasn't it?
Sunny day, and we were tarring and feathering collaborators. And the Welsh burnt the last of the Tories out of their cottages, and it was just a lovely, lovely day. And then now you look back and you just feel like someone who's waited 18 years for a transplant, had a successful operation, then found out the other bloke had the same thing as him.
'18 years of Tory rule was brought to an end with a historic landslide victory for New Labour and Tony Blair on 1st of May 1997. Tory rule was quickly reinstated on the 2nd of May 1997. Alan, listen to this.
They say that breaking up is hard to do. Now I know that it's true. Don't say that this is the end. Instead of breaking up, I wish that we were
Alan, what was the big question in West Lothian?
Oh, right. I think this is about the ongoing process of devolution, whereby by the time the programme goes out, devolution will have gone so far beyond merely Wales, Scotland and England, it'll, you know, the Duchy of Cricklewood will be at war with the People's Republic of Edgware as we devolve down into smaller and smaller areas. And that's what's happened. And it has been a terrible thing. The only good thing about it, as we saw at the last World Cup, is that the Cross of St George has been reinstated, which means if you're going anywhere for a formal evening, it's easier to paint your face. when I were nobbit a lad beginning the news quiz, you had to paint the Union Jack on, and odds were you painted on upside down and millions of people would write to the Telegraph. Devolution.
This devolution thing, though, could work. It could solve the Northern Ireland problem, because if you think about it, Scotland is edging towards independence, and then they might think, well, we'll just sever the union, we'll leave. And then Wales might think, well, if they can do it, we'll leave the union as well. And then actually England could leave the United Kingdom, and we could turn around to David Trimble and say, looks like it's just you now.
Public support for devolution has always been high in Scotland. You only have to watch a single episode of Rabsy Nesbitt to see how far the Scots have devolved. Oh, there'll be letters. We start round two with a cutting from the Times, read by Charlotte Green.
A young girl who was blown out to sea on a set of inflatable teeth was rescued by a man on an inflatable lobster. A Coast Guard spokesman commented, "This sort of thing is all too common."
We've lost the name of the listener who sent that in, but we'd like to thank him and her anyway. Andy, which wall came a-tumbling down?
Well, this is the Berlin Wall, presumably. It's hard to remember now that those of us who grew up assuming that America and Russia would be having a Cold War forever, and it was an astonishing thing when the wall started to come down. I've always been fascinated by Gorbachev, who basically, as far as I can tell, got up one morning and decided to dismantle communism. I've always wondered how he squared it with senior management at the Kremlin. You know, whether there was a Politburo meeting and they got to the end and the secretary said, "Any other business?" And Gorbachev said, "Actually, there is one thing I just wanted to mention." Because it was an extraordinary move by him. Since then, of course, history has been rewritten and we're now told that it wasn't anything to do with Gorbachev, that he was merely a front man for Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, who planned it all along.
When those Germans knock through, they do it grand style, don't they?
Although they might have regretted it a bit, because before, East Germany could play loud music, whereas West Germany, you know, could just read quietly.
Did anyone check whether that wall was load-bearing before they started? That's what bothered me.
I've got a piece of Berlin Wall. Tell me about that, Dick. It looks like a rock cake. If you turn it over, it says number 178369483 on it. There are 17 million other people in the world that if we got together, we could actually say, well, that's history for you. Bring some araldite and we'll put it back. But I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
Is it a fragment of the true Berlin Wall?
No,
scrofula?
Yes, it says, Linda, it says authentic on it.
Oh.
It says it in English, so I don't know who authenticated it, but it says authentic piece of Berlin Wall. I've also got a piece of moon rock. If I ever mix them up, I don't know.
Did you say moon all the way through?
I don't know why I collect these things.
The most famous bit of the war was probably Checkpoint Charlie, where vigilant guards were prepared to stop at nothing to prevent the invasion of Eastern Europe by braless TV gardening experts. Linda, who burgered up British beef?
Ah, well, that would be Mr. Gummer. Was it Selwyn Gummer? Was that really his name?
John Selwyn Gummer, that was
Selwyn
his full name,
Gummer,
yes.
That's right. Sounds like a stage name, really, doesn't it? But anyway, he force-fed his daughter with some mechanically recovered beef fragments formed into the popular snack hamburger on TV to show that there was no danger from BSC, from mad cow disease. And I don't know how old that girl is now, but I suppose she's probably a teenager. Most teenagers just irrationally hate their parents, don't they? You wouldn't want to be round their house over Christmas, would you? Yes, and I haven't forgot. Let's see that again, shall we? Let's watch that film when you tried to kill me. Yes, I would like a flat, thank you. I always found mad cow disease a little bit judgmental as a title, really. Because who's to say they were mad? And also, it's very class-based, because if had they been polo ponies, they'd have been mildly eccentric. On the other hand, I think the cows themselves must bear some responsibility for the spread of the disease, because there's such a word as no when people offer you a bit of diseased sheep brain, isn't there? As if, oh, no, I like it, but it doesn't like me. But I think they're like all vegetarians. They secretly want a bit of meat, and maybe that was their bacon sandwich, as it were. You know, once they'd had it, not one of their bellies could deal with it, could they?
I followed the BSE story really closely because I'm a hypochondriac, and it was one of those moments where you could be very smug, because I'd seen a documentary many, many, many years ago where these government spokesmen have said, well, we don't know what causes it, we don't know what it is, we don't know if it can be transmitted from cow to calf, we don't know if it can be transmitted to humans, we don't know if it's curable, but we know it's safe. And The hypochondriac in me leapt into action, and I ordered my family never to go near any beef. And as the crisis developed, and it turned out that it was transmittable to all sorts of creatures, including us, I followed up a bit on the story, and it became evident that the heart of the problem was that for some reason we had thought it was a good idea to feed bits of diseased sheep to cows. Now, cows are not known for stalking sheep, and you know, they're not up there with the big cats. And I remember following this through and thinking, this is very bizarre. And I saw an interview where they asked a farmer, you know, why did you start feeding bits of meat to cows? And his answer was, because fish became too expensive. And that was true. Hitherto,
that was Farmer Salvador Darwin.
Hitherto, they'd been giving them bits of ground-up fish. So, these bewildered cows.
But at least fish has got omega-3 oils, which means they wouldn't die of a heart attack. But then they don't really live long enough to get heart attacks, cows, do they, really?
No, and they don't go swimming.
But they process it, don't they? It's meat and bone, MBM, which sounds like a sweetie. Cows probably wouldn't fancy it, but it's ground up very small, pumped into sausage skin and served in a bun with mustard and onions in huge bovine cinemas where they all watch cow action flicks to take their minds off what they're eating.
Funny thing is, though, they always throw away the gherkin.
1990 Agriculture Minister John Selwyn Gummer attempted to calm rising panic over British beef by feeding his daughter, Cordelia, a burger. Cordelia survived the ordeal, but Goneril and Regan both went mad. We interrupt round two with a cutting from the Times.
A footballer has claimed the world record for speed and incurring a red card. Lee Todd was sent off after 2 seconds. The referee ordered him off for using foul and abusive language after he blew the whistle for kickoff, and Todd said, "Fuck me, that was loud."
Jeremy, whose Teflon reputation turned out to be far from stainless.
What? Swearing is big and clever, isn't it? Definitely. What did you say, Simon?
Jeremy, whose Teflon reputation turned out to be far from stainless. It's an American question.
Oh, okay. So not Teflon, so stainless as in dress stainless.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Okay. Well, this is rather sad, really. Because it relates to the story of this girl whose life's kind of, well, I don't know, she's disappeared. But there was Bill Clinton, and he's much older than her. He's her party leader, he's her employer, and the most powerful man in the world. She is young, she's naive, she's impressionable, low self-esteem. So he thinks, I know what I'll do. And he has his way with her, and doesn't seem to be very reciprocal. She doesn't get much out of it. She gets quite a lot out of him, but he's obviously not a child of 69. What strikes you is she did this to him 9 times, this particular act, and throughout the questioning, it is always referred to as the act being performed. What is it about this particular activity? You can't just do it or share it or have it. It has to be performed.
All right, love, from the top.
Yeah, it's a rather tawdry tale, but he did very well. He went on to bomb the hell out of Yugoslavia and all sorts, didn't he?
She was having sexual relations with him, but he wasn't having sexual relations with her. That's how it was explained.
No.
I thought I was perfectly straightforward.
I think that's clear. It didn't mean anything to him, therefore he was not having sexual relations with
exactly.
her.
Exactly.
He was not in a relationship.
No, he was just sitting quietly in his office.
Mm. He was taking calls. He was on the phone during some of it.
Mm. Oh, that's flattering.
Yeah.
If you're president, you're very busy. You can't handle one thing at a time, can you?
I think it's called multitasking.
Monica wasn't the first person to discover that a temporary job as a White House intern could lead to a permanent role on the president's staff. Alan, which litigious, lying, cheating, perjuring ex-peer... is unlikely to sue whatever you say.
There's no way to treat a stalwart of the News Quiz, Simon. I think you're referring to prisoner FF8282, also known as Lord Archer of Weston-super-Mare. Except he isn't in Weston-super-Mare at the moment. He is in HMP North Sea Camp. They always make it sound like ships, don't they? Her Majesty's Prison North Sea Camp.
He is in Chokey. Radio 4 listeners may not know this man. Maybe beyond them, he's a major British novelist. He spent a life committed to fiction, which is why they've committed him to North Sea Camp. The very sad thing about it, from my point of view, is that for a year he's been away from the News Quiz. I mean, he's our great raw material. What he's actually doing, well, as you probably know, he's a medical orderly.
He probably tells people he's a real doctor.
Oh, he really is. Well, no, he's probably a consultant by now. They let him do everything except keyhole surgery up there.
And a cricket umpire in his spare time.
Yes, well, you can trust me, I'm an umpire. But that's who it is. And he came a... He came a that is one of his mistresses screaming. She is sneezing at the memory of the brevity of her last association.
The bizarre thing of all was, when Archer was finally sent down, the judge, Potts, I think he was called, said, "Sentencing you gives me no pleasure, Lord Archer." Extraordinary. All the people in Britain who could have had so much pleasure out of them. The one man in the country who didn't think this was hugely enjoyable.
I feel sorry for Mary Archer. Now he's in prison, she has to visit him regularly.
I'm just sorry for him because he told all these porkies and persuaded other people to tell porkies. And all those buggers who knew they were porkies all along but knew there was something in it for them are still running out there free, and he is pissing in a bucket.
Mm. Well, those are wise words, Alan.
Well, when what? I...
It's the disgrace. Say what you like about Archer, though. He is a true artist because nobody will appreciate him until he's dead.
Throughout their last term of office, the Tories were plagued by a series of high-profile cases of perjury and deceit relating to Archer, Aitken and Ashcroft, A to A of Conservative sleaze. We start round three with an item from the York Evening Press.
The Rawcliffe area was one of the worst hit by flooding last autumn. Derek Rode described the floods as the most traumatic thing he'd experienced since being blown up at a bus stop in 1944.
Andy, listen to this. In the 25 years of the News Quiz, why does that commemorate one sporting event England did fairly well in?
Actually, I've often been compared to Pavarotti. But Pavarotti after a tree fell on him. this is the World Cup in Italy, which, of course, really became, well, the story, I suppose, there was Gazza's tears, and then Gareth Southgate's... Southgate, was it? Who was it? It was Pearce.
Stuart Pearce and Chris Waddle.
You see, missed penalties. We've now lost so many penalty shootouts that it's like Kings of England. They all sort of blur into each other. And it seems that...
Divorced, beheaded, flopsy, mopsy, cottontail, except in January alone when there are six.
Yeah, Pearce, Waddle, Southgate, Batty. The failed penalty shootout has become really the symbol of British national life. It's almost like the narrative for the whole of the 80s and 90s. But the thing about World Cup Italia was it marked a huge increase in the sort of popularity of the game, and it was the beginning. 1990 was really the beginning of the sort of gentrification of football, and it was when people like Nick Hornby started writing books about the emotional aspects of supporting Arsenal. And you got footy lit. And it was also the time when, of course, Sky came barging in and bought up all the football. That was the other thing. A lot of women apparently turned onto football because a slightly chubby footballer started to cry, which I found hard to believe.
It was Italia 90, the first World Cup, that made football popular with the middle classes. Gazza famously burst into tears and became utterly inconsolable. And this year, as a TV pundit during Japan 02, Gazza became utterly incomprehensible.
Well, Terry Venables was translating for him, wasn't he? Sure. From idiot to wide boy.
During the England-Germany game, the British fans sang two World Wars and one World Cup. doodah. To which German fans replied, two World Cup, 16 Olympics and 50 years of uninterrupted economic progress. Doodah. John, what left us saying, hello, 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 dolly, dolly, dolly?
This is easy. This is Dolly the Sheep. If you remember, they took out a bit of a sheep's udder and injected it into an egg. It's all rather complicated, but a completely identical sheep was produced, which is not that difficult, is it? Anyway. The scientists got very excited, and people start talking about dictators cloning themselves. Then the news came through that Dolly had got arthritis, and she was prematurely aging.
God, prematurely aging. Maybe William Hague was a clone.
Dolly's not dead.
No, but Dolly's about, in sort of human terms, Dolly's about 150 now.
She's not dead, but she does live in sheltered accommodation.
She's got a stair lift.
Her niece is marvellous. Honestly, she's marvellous. She has to come on two buses, but... Meals on Wheels gets a bit samey, but...
People saying, what if they clone Saddam Hussein? And you think, yeah, but what if they do? Because if he's cloned and he's brought up in Stoke, it's going to make no odds, is it? He'll just...
Oh, you think Stoke brings out the best in people?
No. He might still be dysfunctional, but he wouldn't necessarily think, oh, do you know, I've a mind to invade Iraq now.
Just be fighting with lads from Utoxeter.
Yeah. It's not about inheritance, it's about environment. You can inherit male pattern baldness from your mother's father, but not a tendency to fight in the First World War.
No, Jeremy, people are just born evil. That's a scientific fact.
Oh, yeah, because of Eve.
Exactly.
The incredible cloning
achievement. It's such a terrible magazine.
You wouldn't know it was all printed from recycled ribs, would you? Go on, Simon. You go for it, man.
The incredible.
It's determined to butt in, isn't it?
Oh. The last few years, if people only knew what we have to put up with.
Chatting away, all of a sudden, questions.
Go on, then. Oh, now you don't want to. Well, I don't think you know what you want, really, Simon.
Release.
You want to be
release.
Caught, really.
Closure. Russians tried to clone a mammoth by inserting its DNA into an elephant. Later, they tried to insert elephant DNA into a young hen, with the hope of producing a chicken that can remember why it crossed the road. Alan, which new mode of transport's arrival was greeted with a less than electric reception?
Yeah. About 15, maybe 20 years ago, you told me you got it in front of you when I was a lot slimmer. I road-tested one of these. It's the world's smallest car. They sent it round. It was like a motorised condom. I just sort of put it on. It's called a Sinclair C5. It's the worst car ever built. And it was... Well, they won't know this on radio, but it was that high, you'll have to guess. And it was a swine to drive because pedestrians trod on you. And whenever you stopped, which was very frequently, it didn't have a roof, so you were susceptible to dog whittle. The way it worked, I mean, Clive Sinclair built this thing. He made a lot of money out of little computers. And he built this thing. And the way it worked was you put a U2 battery in it and you left it in your garage overnight and it charged up. And then you'd drive down your drive and about 8 yards up the road and it would stop. You would then pick it up, put it under your arm, run back to your car and put it in the boot so that you could go to work. I suppose it's a reflection of the honour system that he built it and got a knighthood. I don't know where they are now. Occasionally you see them, don't you? I mean, you see them outside. The Nautilus Fitness Club has them dotted. You see a few as hanging baskets. And then very occasionally, if you're crossing the Yorkshire Dales or in some remote spot, you see one with a skeleton at the wheel. Sod who's run out of electricity in the middle of nowhere. But that it was the Sinclair C5, and rather like Dolly the Sheep, but we don't know where it is now.
I think he just got the idea from the Flintstones, didn't he? It was the Flintstones car, in essence, wasn't it?
They built a two-seater, and it didn't, really, genuinely, it's not a joke, it didn't move at all. I got in with my friend Alastair Sams and we started the engine and it just wouldn't do it. And he was sat there going, in the middle of the North Circular Road while lorry drivers spat on you. I don't whether any of them was ever successful.
Did you know that the C5 was powered by a washing machine engine?
Well, all of them?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Nothing like as useful. It was always messing up the coloureds and whites. But I think we've got to be careful about being too hard on Clive Sinclair, you know. These inventors, it's not easy inventing things, is it, Linda?
I find it quite tricky, yeah. Yes.
Well, and he did the pocket calculator and the home computer. The guy who invented the wheel probably didn't do much after that. But no, it's not easy, is it, keep on inventing things?
But if the wheel was a bit better than C5. I mean, he took up a hill, it rolled down. C5 wouldn't move anywhere.
I wonder if they floated. Maybe they could be used as pedalos.
Hmm.
They disgust me, those pedalos. I think the police should tell us where they are.
Very good.
They need to be helped, not punished.
No, but they always hang around in parks. They know what they're doing.
The C5 was named...
They have to worry ducks.
They're going, orange, orange.
The C5
crispy
was...
Crispy aromatic.
Plum sauce.
The C5 was named...
A swan will break your arm.
They're all American.
Turn your back on a hedgehog.
The C5 was named by Sinclair's stock controller after a disbelieving Sir Clive asked how many had been sold, and the stock controller said, C5! The battery-powered vehicle had a top speed of 15 miles an hour on the road and an astonishing 90 miles an hour when its owners pushed it off the nearest cliff. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the very best of the cuttings our teams have retrieved from the dog-eared scrapbook of News Quiz memories. Andy.
I'm dreading the end of the show. I'm going to have to do these trousers up. There'll be a loud explosion somewhere over West London. Right. This is from a Parish magazine in 1996. After his cat got stuck in a tree, a minister from South Africa mounted a rescue operation. He climbed a ladder as far as he could, tied one end of a rope round the narrow trunk and the other end to his car bumper. As he drove forward, bending the tree down towards the ground, the inevitable happened. The rope broke, and the tree catapulted the Moggy into space. A couple of weeks later, the minister was in the supermarket when he saw one of his church members buying cat food. "I didn't know you had a cat," he said. "Minister, it's quite a miracle, really." "But 2 weeks ago, I was having a picnic on the lawn with my daughter. Mummy, I'd love to have a cat," she said. I said to her, "You'll have to ask Jesus for one." At that very moment, this cat came flying through the air, landed on the lawn, and he's stayed with us ever since.
This is from the Birmingham Post. One of the mistresses of disgraced TSB boss Graham Doughty says the bank will have difficulty in recovering some of the cash he stole because she invested it in £5,000 worth of breast implants. Last night, a spokesman for the TSB said, "These things are in the hands of our solicitors."
Linda.
Here's a really short little one from 1989, Sunday Mail. An autographed photograph of Margaret Thatcher fetched £1.60 at a school auction sale in Oyne, Aberdeenshire. A box of haddock raised £8.
Jeremy.
This is from the days when Barry Took was our chair, Barry, that we lost this year. And it's from The Guardian, and it says, after being charged £20 for a £10 overdraft, 30-year-old Michael Howard of Leeds changed his name by deed-poll to Yorkshire Bank PLC, our fascist bastards. The bank has now asked him to close his account, and Mr. Bastards has asked them to repay the 69p balance by cheque made out in his new name.
Francis.
From the Churchtown Parish magazine. Would the congregation please note that the bowl at the back of the church labelled for the sick is for monetary donations only?
We're having
done this nonsense right from the beginning, Simon. I sort of accumulated more than anybody, and I can't really... I was always a lousy editor. I can't choose them. I'll give you a couple. This goes back to 1980. It's from the Toronto Globe and Mail, and it reads, Edwina McKenzie, now 91, credits her long life to having decided 68 years ago to get off the Titanic. Quite like this one from 1996 in the Pretoria Chronicle. Corporate facilities are to be extended at Transvaal Cricket Club because now that more and more wives and girlfriends attend matches, members have complained that their boxes often become uncomfortably full. In 1998, the Butts Free Press. My children have grown up and left home. My husband is out all day and I'm looking round for a rewarding outlet for my energies. Do you think it would be a good idea to start breeding with my Labrador? Surrey and Hampshire Star. Surrey East Borough Council want an HGV driver operator for the cesspool emptying and refuse collection service. A clean driving licence is essential.
Thank you all. Let's look at the final scores. Alan, Francis and Jeremy have a magnificent 18 points, but Andy, John and Linda have won, thanks to my unique scoring system, with 19 points. And before we leave you, here's an item from 1997, selected exclusively for this programme by Charlotte Green.
In Sydney, rejected spouse Arnon Pumpleweed parachuted into his wife's second marriage disguised as a penis. Mr. Pumpleweed had been devastated when wife Marcia left him, citing as her reason his failure to satisfy her sexually. When she announced she was remarrying, he realised drastic action was needed. It was an outdoor ceremony, he explained, and I decided to skydive into it wearing a penis costume. The idea was to land on the altar and shout, "Is this big enough for you, Marcia?" Unfortunately, as Mr. Pumpleweed descended from on high, he was blown off course by freak winds, landing instead in the middle of a teddy bear's picnic for deprived children. We told the kids it was a tall pink teddy with a funny hat on, sighed the picnic's organiser, but I don't think they believed us.
That's goodbye.
Taking part in 25 years of the News Quiz were Alan Corran, Andy Hamilton, Jeremy Hardy, John Sargent, Linda Smith and Francis Ween. The Jubilee chairman was Simon Hoggett and the news was read by Corrie Caulfield, Charlotte Green, Brian Perkins and me, Peter Donaldson. The chairman's script was written by Dave Cohn, Simon Littlefield, Paul McKenzie and George Poles, and the producer was Lucy Armitage.